This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Bahamas. My name is Erin Green, and you are on the clock. Today, Wednesday, February the 10th, 2021. And boy, just in case you didn't know, juju season is winding down. If you haven't found your perfect sweet juju yet, you still have one, maybe two more weeks to search them out. Don't leave a juju tree unattended. Walk up to it, say good morning. Love it up a little bit. Don't give it a rub, you know, don't rub it down. Don't touch it. It prickly. And you know what I realize? I realize that the juju tree probably developed those prickles for a particular reason. Here's what it is. I've been trying to figure out how to propagate juju trees. How do I get a juju tree? Can I get it from seed, right? And having a very difficult time. Most people say you got to look under juju tree shortly after juju season to find juju seedlings. But then I realized that when I got caught by a prickle sticking my hand up in somebody's juju tree that I may or may not have had permission to do, I realized that the prickles are there for a purpose. The juju tree probably wants you and I to not pick the juju from the tree. The juju tree wants us to wait until the juju falls on the ground. Why? Because I think some people have found that juju seeds that have been crushed or cracked in some way are more likely to germinate, right? And so I realized the tree probably developed the prickles to keep you out the tree, to encourage the falling, right, the dropping of fruit from the tree. Hit the ground where it is more likely to be crushed and viable for germination. That's something, hey? These plants smart. Sometimes I believe they smarter than us humans. On the clock, we engage organizations, institutions, social and cultural leaders, and ordinary people to better understand the impact of public policy, private sector development, and emerging social and consumer trends. On the clock, we have conversations that help us understand and navigate a rapidly changing Bahamas. So if you haven't had a juju yet for the day, you got to get one, because a juju a day keeps the doctor away. You're listening to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. We're streaming live, audio and video, on guardiantalkradio.com. You can listen on TV, on Cable Bahamas Channel 969, or on Flow, channel 612. Or you can download the Guardian Radio app for your Apple or Android smart devices and listen to our audio feed or watch us on our video feed right there on the Guardian Radio app. You can text us on the Guardian Radio text line, 422-GR96. That's 422-4796. And that's powered by BTC. Standard text rates apply. You can also call us at 323-6232. That's 323-6232. 325-4316, 325-4316, or 326-4259. Good morning, Bahamas. I've got a guest with me today, but before I introduce my guest, I wanted to touch a couple things in the newspaper. There's so many things to touch in the newspaper. So many cabinet ministers obviously requiring attention and support, both civil service and private sector and civil society support in doing their jobs. But before I talk about the drastic drop in unemployment statistics or the government COVID vaccine passport, I want to draw your attention to a series of conversations going on about the same issue. There is an editorial in today's Guardian, a letter to the editor, written by Maurice Tynes that addresses the resignation of Halston Mutrie from FNM and, I guess, the implications for the office or position of the speaker. And in today's National Review, Candia Dames also focuses on and interrogates the decision of the speaker to resign from the FNM party. And I'm going to suggest that we read both of these pieces along with commentary that would have been published earlier in the week and last week. It's a very interesting read. Maurice Tynes is obviously an expert or a local expert and speaks with authority and lays out some very interesting positions in his letter. But what one of the things that Candia Dame says I just want to touch on is that it doesn't add up, or that National Review touches on, that it doesn't add up, right? While the speaker gave his resignation from the party, he didn't resign from his role as speaker, right? That maybe it's more about politics than governance, right? This decision to resign. And I think Maurice Tynes intimates or reflects, shares the same sentiment. But I want to offer here, you know, what they're saying is, you know, you resign to show your commitment to your position, that you feel that the executive branch or that the administration is ignoring its obligations to the principle of separation of powers and to the legislature. And I say, maybe in this one particular instance, remaining speaker is the best way, right, to express your continued displeasure and disagreement with that, with those particular functions. Because once you resign, you no longer a member of the party, backbencher, you ain't get a chance to say anything. And you know the boy them gonna treat you the same way you treated them when they were in opposition or backbenchers and had no real political power. So if I were the speaker, I would stay and I would continue to express my displeasure from that position. Now, I am not learned as Maurice Tynes, and perhaps he is not allowed to behave in that manner. But I sketch Chikchanis, and I don't really care that much about behavior. I would stay, and every day remind them how far across the line they have wandered, right? Every day I would annoy them to pieces. And as a reminder that they cannot ignore this issue, like, you know, they like to ignore all kinds of other issues. In fact, I would tell them, don't you dare put me on the same shelf you obviously put that Oban file that you can't find. But that's just me, and I am not really a good politician. And so I want to encourage us again to please, if you have the time, if you can't pick up the paper, wait for the online publication to be uploaded, and check out National Review and an excellently well-worded piece by Maurice Tynes. Summing up some of the legal and political and parliamentary issues involved. I also want to touch on this headline by the Minister of National Security, Marvin Daines, who said he is very concerned by a recent allegation that a member of the Royal Bahamas Defense Force raped his colleague. He goes on to say, I have no concern about the safety of officers. And I am sitting here stunned. He said, however, I'm very concerned about those allegations. What exactly are you saying? But furthermore, were you disturbed by the allegations of rape and statutory rape that arose with the Nygaard affair? And what is the Ministry of National Security doing to move on that matter? I just would like you all to take the issue of rape more seriously. I'd like you all to stop using terms like unlawful sex when unnecessary, right? We know that there is a category of crimes in the law called unlawful sex, but we also know that those acts are actually rape. And we want to call them what they are, rape, right? Also, the government considering COVID vaccine passport. I hope that the government is prepared to have a conversation with the Bahamian public and has created a mechanism or a vehicle to facilitate dissemination of information and the collection of opinions and responses from the Bahamian public. This is too important to treat like other matters that you say, you know, you're just considering it, and then all of a sudden there's a bill being tabled in the House, and the people are wondering where was their opportunity to participate in this dialogue, and in particular, a discussion about their health, right? We're talking about our health, and we would like to be a part of the conversation. It's just too much stuff in the paper for me to touch on today. I can be honest with y'all. I really, really just wanted to root through the paper, but I have a guest who is even more exciting than the political critique I had prepared for some of these guys today. And so, to our guest. My guest today is returning from last week. We had a full discussion, and we have to continue it, especially since it's still Africans in the Americas History Month. See, I could do that. I could change the name, right? I mean, I'm not Biden. I'm not in control of blackness. But I could call it Africans in the Americas History Month if I want, because I'm African in the Americas. The most interesting part of the conversation last week, though, was the connections that the callers made to religion, spirituality, and ancestry. But 1 month ago, we celebrated Majority Rule Day. Majority rule is an intergenerational and a transgenerational, right? So that means that not only is it a movement that requires multiple generations to engage it at one time, it is also a movement that spans generations. It's a movement that started hundreds of years before our time with the lives of enslaved Africans. Not slaves, but enslaved Africans. It is a story of ancestors that demanded an end to apartheid in the Bahamas. But it is also our story, our movement. We all have a duty to maintain the freedoms we have achieved and to push forward to ensure everyone has every opportunity to live a life free of violence in all forms. Because nothing of real value can be achieved or sustained by one single generation of people. So yesterday was an important day in Bahamian history, and one that we don't talk about. In fact, I had no idea until Mr. Chris Davis, my guest today, brought it to my attention. Arlington, is Chris on the line? Chris, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Good morning, Chris. Look here. Reintroduce yourself.
You hear me?
I can hear you. Reintroduce yourself. Tell the Bahamian people who you are and what you do.
I'm Christopher Davis. My day job. I'm the historical interpreter, you know, and I'm also a researcher at the Antiquities Monument Museum Corporation. And of course, myself, I'm a Pan-African, African internationalist, whatever you want to call it, historian that focuses intricately on Black or African Bahamian history, and particularly how we relate to the rest of the diaspora as it regards to the ongoing Maafa. If that makes sense. Maafa being the Swahili word for the great, great big disaster, which encompasses the Arab slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, colonization, gentrification, the new Jim Crow in America, systematic racism globally, and the whole nine.
And apartheid in places like the Bahamas and South Africa.
Yeah, the colonial period, the imperial period, the so-called Victorian era, which is probably the African diaspora's equivalent to make a probably distasteful comparison to, you know, the Holocaust, if you want to call it that. And yeah, but that's what I'm all about. And those who know me know the perspective that I attempt to bring to the historical rhetoric.
Absolutely. And I made the point of framing... reframing Black History Month, right? Which is a reframing of its original name, which was African American History Month.
Right.
And History Month, we can hold it as authentic if we see it in the sense that it really examines the impact of Black of culture, right? Like of African culture in the U.S. But we know that it has that we are more than just entertainment.
Yeah.
We are more than just culture in that sense. And so I say that to say this, that today we are, you know, I called it what it is, Africans in the Americas History Month, because I think it's more important to focus on ancestry versus race, right?
Most definitely,
and
yeah.
So I know people who would be identified as white, but truly they identify as European descent. They, they don't identify with the culture of whiteness.
Right.
And so some of those people are Bahamian, and their connection to the Bahamas is not as white Bahamians, but as Bahamians of Europe. Right. Which I think is an important distinction to make. And so, you know, I just want my listeners to know that we are not talking about race or critiquing race in the sort of traditional sense you would see out there, especially in American media. We want to talk about ancestry more than race. You still there, Chris?
Yeah, I hear now. Yeah, I can hear you now. I don't know what happened. It's not. I just cut out.
All right. Don't worry.
Our internet, the proverbial Bahamian problem, right?
Yeah, we could talk about that in a couple of weeks. But so, I told the audience yesterday was an important anniversary. Tell us what we didn't celebrate yesterday.
Well, it was actually day before yesterday, February 8th. And this would have been the 199th. Anniversary, if you will, of the execution of a great Bahamian hero who is arguably the one deserving of the most commemoration that he doesn't get, if you're coming from. You know, he's an unequivocal Bahamian hero. I don't think anyone would deny after you hear what he did and what he's responsible for, that he is a Bahamian hero. And we don't have, to my knowledge, any official Bahamian heroes that actually fought for us, that died for us, that fought against chattel slavery in the Bahamas, which would have been our lowest period, whether you look at it socially, whether you look at it morally, in any way, shape, or form. So it's puzzling to me why in the Bahamas we seem to commemorate colonial governors and genocidal maniacs like Queen Victoria and prolific slave traders like Woodes Rogers, when those that fought for us, you know, during our most dire times, are pretty much pushed to the back pages of history.
Absolutely. But stick a pin for a second. Hold on, stick a pin. Let's give some context. People are going to get very upset when you call Queen Elizabeth a genocidal maniac.
Well, I call her Victoria. Oh,
sorry, Victoria. My bad. Victoria.
Queen Elizabeth has benefited greatly from those genocides, and as the African diaspora has inherited all of the traumas, and science has now shown us that even physical, emotional, and mental trauma can be passed through the generations. So just as we've inherited the trauma, people of European descent, particularly those of royal families, the mercantile classes and the planter classes of old, they benefit from the benefits that are produced from our mafia.
Right. But I want to give a current day context. People say, oh, you call Queen Victoria a genocidal maniac, you know.
Did she
go to war? You know, did she slaughter anybody? But you know, a current reference is President Obama. And it's noted that President Obama presided over the most drone strikes, right?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, sorry, let me interject there. You know, this is the funny thing about history. And this is how you say history is written by the winners. And this is something that the United States imperialism has been guilty of throughout our modern history, you know, where they suffer attacks and the backlash for those attacks are literally thousands and thousands times fold, especially when you look at the death toll. You understand? Mm-hmm. Furthermore, most of the, without exception, all of the attacks that they've experienced have been at places like military bases, you know, places that are beacons of American culture, of American society, especially from a political perspective. Whereas when they hit back at people that they had what, you know, they bombed villages. And it started out with them having one extremist Muslim group to deal with, and now they have three extremist Muslim groups to deal with, Al-Qaeda and even ISIS, the bigger one. And the two have grown and have blossomed more and have more passionate followers now, basically because of the way that American imperialism works, which is the total disregard for human life when they create their boogeyman, you know. So at one point it was the Cold War and the boogeyman were communists. And of course, Africans are always brought into that, you know, Patrice Lumumba and the people that they label communists and socialists. And they were willing to back people like Papa Doc Duvalier simply because he wasn't socialist and they didn't want the quote unquote socialism and communism of Fidel Castro to infect the rest of us good black Negroes here in the Bahamas and other places.
Mm-hmm. And a current example of the impact of those types of imperialist policies, right?
Right.
Is sort of a trickle-down effect. Right. ISIS is the new boogeyman, right? And you often broadcasters talking about ISIS and ISIS in the Caribbean. Well, I saw a news report. I know it's been floating around there from the American media, where a journalist was referencing ISIS in the Caribbean, and then had the audacity to mistakenly say that the largest home, that the majority of those Caribbean ISIS members are coming from the Bahamas.
Oh, man.
And I wanted to write and tell them, but buddy, I will terrorize your mango tree, but that's about it.
Exactly, you know, and it's crazy how they pretty much blanket all, they constantly do it, they blanket entire groups of Muslims, and they erroneously refer to the entire Islamic community, you know, and they say, like, you know, Muslim extremism, and you know, mm-hmm. but you don't use terms like Christian extremism, or you understand? So it's a huge quadruple standard.
But let's get back to Dick.
Yeah.
Is it Dick?
Right.
Is Dick DeVoe or Dick DeLaVoe?
Dick DeVoe. His surname came because he was formerly owned by one of those loyalists that we love to lotion, Colonel Andrew DeVoe, who in his zenith was about the third biggest slave owner in the Bahamas, right?
Wow.
But he was absorbed into the plantation, pretty much Joseph Hunter, his daughter Sarah Poitier, who married Charles Poitier, who had passed away about a decade before this revolt happened. And then you also had Henry Michael Williams. Now, all of these people, as those who are familiar with loyalist history, many of these people are the who's who's, you know, these we're talking about. All of them are lawyers, you know, all of them were acting governors, former acting governors, the former controller of customs. And when I get to spend too much time on the story, I'll try to tell it in a short time while getting at the key point. But as I tell the story, you will see how the political and social clout that these men possessed helped them how complex things could be. So if you don't mind, I'll get right into the story.
Mm-hmm.
Tell people what happened, because it's one that I think everybody should know about, especially people from my beloved Kid Island. You know, I have a Kid Island bias.
Yeah.
Right. So essentially in 1831, Christmas fell on a Sunday, right? A lot of sources kind of like to place these slave revolts and any uprising, like even the Burma Road uprising, you know, the general strike, they like to like single out this one event that and make it seem like that's what happened. But these things, these uprisings happened from a consistent bad treatment over a long period of time. And that was the situation right there in Southern Kid Island. The Kid Island is called it Killing Grove, but the real quote unquote proper English way of saying it is Grove. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is Christmas fell on a Sunday and they were not allotted one of the extra days that they were usually given. Right. So this goes against that rhetoric of how, quote-unquote Bahamian slave masters love to give slaves all these days off, right? Mm-hmm. So it's decided between Hunter and Williams that they wouldn't receive this thing. Now, Dick DeVoe was actually the driver on this plantation. And in many of slave revolts all through the diaspora, you see that you realize that the driver, the guy, the slave, the head slave in charge, if you will, was the guy that actually led the revolt in many incidences, right? Now, in this time, Dick DeVoe, they were supposed to come back out to work on the Wednesday. Dick DeVoe told his gang, his family, who would have been his cousins, nieces, nephews, wife, children, not to come out when I ring the bell on Wednesday. And that's what happened. And this infuriated Hunter and Henry William Sarah. And there was a lot of arguments that was building up since that Christmas Day through Boxing Day up until that Wednesday. And when Dick DeVoe rang that bell and didn't come out to work, they decided they would punish them. So on the Thursday morning, they had a bunch of oranges out. And it was two young guys who was there. One of their names actually was Young Guy, right? And he was one of the people that was sent to Nassau after the revolt to stand trial, okay, out of the 10. And essentially, they wanted to whip Young Guy and another guy named Young William for not picking up these oranges, because this is one of the many things that they did. And he actually accused them of stealing the orange because apparently one of them picked it up and ate it without their permission. You know, they like to find any reason to whip and to exert their authority. And what happened was Dick DeVoe famously said, this is one of my favorite quotes, you know, my people will not now be flogged as they have previously done. Okay, so this here telling his slave master and the slave master next door, this ain't happening today, ain't no one getting whipped. Now, of course, this is not just about Christmas, because Dick DeVoe makes several references telling Henry Williams, hey, you never do nothing good for black people anyway. You know, this was you could feel the Bahamian spirit, you know, in this revolt when you look at the exchanges between these people. And the following day, after Dick prevented the whipping of any of the slaves on that day, they had another argument. And I don't know what happened, but something in Dick DeVoe, I guess you could say, snapped. And it was not only Dick DeVoe, of course, it was Dick DeVoe and over 50 other people that took part in this uprising. His two sons, William and Wally, were his second in command. Sorry, Richard and Wally, not William. Richard and Wally were his two sons. And they were the second in command. And Richard was the real, real bigoted one. You know, they had their guns and they was walking around the plantation. And, you know, there's talk about him saying, boy, you come running right now. Like shoot him up and do this and do that. You know, he was talking a lot.
Yeah.
So what happened was they entered the yard where Henry Williams and Poitier and Sarah was, as well as Sarah's two young children that she had had with Charles Poitier, who had passed away. Okay. And they were saying, you know, Henry Williams was saying, hey, y'all, be disarmed. You know, they were completely taken aback that these people were not obeying them. And when you know how the power dynamics works in those days, it was completely unacceptable for any slave to even talk back, including in the Bahamas, especially to men like Henry Williams and Joseph Hunter, who were considered the quote-unquote most honorable men, you know, the lawyers, the esquires, the MPs, and the like.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, Henry Williams actually fired the first shot, and Dick DeVoe fired back. And there was a lot of clubbing going on, and two of the slaves were wounded. The story is very heavily plays in the favor, of course, of the slave master.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a few of the slaves were wounded, but you don't see in the court documents and in the testimonies anything that was happening. Big reason being because slaves were not allowed to give evidence in court, particularly against any white person. And the only time that they made special arrangement for that is if they knew that the enslaved people would actually testify on behalf of the slave master, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So essentially it ended with the army, with members of the West Indian Regiment and members of the British Navy coming to the island. And then they took 10 of the major conspirators, inclusive of two women. Now, you can't leave the sisters out, Linda and Charlotte. And Linda and Charlotte, in this revolt, they was actually trying to throw rocks at the slave master. And Henry Williams leveled his gun at them. And that's what caused him to scurry away. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the people actually passed away from this revolt too. The guy probably was wounded. They claimed that he was wounded by Dick DeVoe's shot, which is something that I personally don't believe, because this was something that was a uniform revolt. Dick was in front. His two sons were behind him. Dick was the only one who was dressed in all white, and everybody else, the women were dressed in petticoats, and all of the men were stripped down to the waist. You understand? So this was something that was uniform. This wasn't something that was one simple disagreement between the driver and the slave master. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Y'all follow me. You can still hear me?
Yeah. We got you.
Great. So essentially, when these guys and women made it and they stood trial, now six of them were sentenced to be hung. And James Carmichael Smith, James Carmichael Smith is one, you know, the great doctor, Christopher Curry, he shares my sentiment in this, where we give, he's the one colonial governor that we love to put on this pedestal as this kind of racist, anti-slavery type of guy.
Slow down a bit.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, right. So I know you're going on. Now, when they arrived, they stood trial. Dick DeVoe was the only one who was sentenced to death. Now, when James Carmichael Smith got pressured, because of course, if you have a slave revolt, you know, you expect that the main conspirator is going to be executed and hung.
Yeah.
James Carmichael Smith's response to this, he said that a chain with such feeble links should not be strained. Speaking to the revolutionary attitude that was popular, not just in Kidd Island, but throughout the Bahamas. Kidd Island was just one that was almost in constant, different forms of constant resistance from the turn of the 1830s right up to the ending of the apprenticeship period in 1838. And the real reason James Carmichael Smith did this is because there was still a lot of unrest. In Southern Kidd Island, we're extremely upset that they had taken these people to trial and everything was not cool as we stay in the Bahamas.
So Carmichael was saying, be easy, don't rile the people up any more than they already are.
Right. And what actually happened was the Williams slaves, who was on the neighboring Newfield plantation and who were also involved and would have at least witnessed this revolt and would, of course, had family members between the two plantations. You know, this one sister married this one brother on that plantation. So it's very close kinship. While that trial was going on, they actually sacked an American schooner called North American. 23 of them sack the schooner, take everything from them, hold the crew on the ship hostage. And a lot of this was due to the fact that they were still upset and they still had this revolutionary spirit bubbling up in them. And also because, you know, they was hungry and they were always heavily neglected.
And they were enslaved. It's not like everything was hunky-dory and then this one thing happened. And now we said it's a period of enslavement. But Chris, we're sort of running out of time. Let me ask you this. Where can we find this, you know, where can we find this story? And are there any documented, linkages to the present day? Right? Like, can I go and touch a monument? Is there a family tree that I could find to see if I'm related to this particular DeVoe?
I could name you some people who are related, descended directly from Dick DeVoe, but whose ancestors would be there. And this was what's so interesting about it. So present at this revolt, particularly on the Joseph Hunter plantation, were the great-great-grandparents who came directly from the Niger Delta, from the Igbo people.
Right.
So I trace Sidney Poitier roots actually back to the Niger Delta.
And his
great-great-grandparents were there and present during the revolts. Marsh Poitier being one of them, and the other names escape me right now. And then another guy, and we know Sidney Poitier being the first Black man to win Best Actor, pioneering figure in Black American entertainment. But there's another pioneering figure in Black American entertainment called Burt Williams, and his grandfather would have been an infant. And he was owned by Henry Williams. His name was Frederick Williams Sr. But he would have been the second one, but he had another child who would have been Frederick Williams III, who was the father of Burt Williams. Burt Williams being the first Black man on Broadway, first Black man to direct a film, first Black man to do this, first Black man to do that, 8-time best recording selling artist. He really is the real pioneer of American entertainment, whether we're talking about white or Black people.
Well,
and here
yeah.
we have a Bahamian. Who went to America and became the second in America as a quote-unquote Black man, even during
Chris,
the Blackface Bonneville era.
Hold on. I just have to love myself for a minute. Because could you imagine that Joseph Spence, Sidney Poitier, and Burt Williams, they are the fathers of modern urban entertainment. Right? And so if you were Bahamian today, for 5 seconds, you could have the biggest attitude you want. Right, but try to do it in your car by yourself. Don't project it on other people. Right, but just know that much of yourself. Now, we can move to another question, but let me tell you why I'm so excited about this segment, especially juxtaposed to today's papers, right?
Right.
We need a new system of deciding who's going to be our heroes and our celebrities.
For sure.
Right? We got to stop making celebrities and heroes out of politicians. But you typically, you know, the people who you see the most and hear about the most, right? The ones we write about the politicians all the time. And that's why I want to not just have different types of conversations, right? But I want, like, this particular conversation. I'm not promoting violence, right? Because peace is not the absence of violence. It's the presence of justice, right? I'm not promoting violence, but this story is important. Dick DeVoe's life and the documentation of that story is important because we need to identify what are the real values that we are going to celebrate in this society, right?
Right,
Who are we going
to...
To add
to that too, I'm sure you should be familiar with Walter Rodney.
Yes.
And he has a very powerful quote. Mm-hmm. And I'll paraphrase it, but essentially he says, what type of immoral person would even dare to compel the slave against that of the slave master?
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's impossible for an enslaved person to murder their slave master because they are enslaved by that person and they are under duress. Just like if I come in that studio right now, hypothetically speaking, put a gun to your head, kidnap you and carry you somewhere, I make you work for free, I do nothing to you. I only take you from where you're supposed to be by force. And you kill me to escape, you are completely justified and you shouldn't spend a day in jail for that.
And let's bring it a little closer to home, right? We look at the situation that arose in one of the children's homes recently, and we had one of the kids express his sentiment that if you don't beat them, they could beat you, right? And how do you express to people that is not an equal, that's not balance of power, right? There's nothing balance about that. You were the person
exactly,
in charge.
Right.
But so, Chris, you know? I gotta here's what we're going to do. I got a caller on the line. We're going to go to that caller, then I got another big question for you. You're on the clock.
A quality day to your voice along with you and your guest, Aaron.
Good morning, sir. How you doing?
I'm holding, thank God.
Bless
you. What I want to know, right?
Uh-huh.
What was the philosophy used in order to get ISIS into that violent situation?
I'll answer that. So for a long time, you know, you had this, what they love to call, remember you mentioned that term, boogeyman, this Islamic extremists, right? And the funny thing is, there's actually a pretty funny parody show. I don't know if you would be interested in it, but it's a show done by the creators of South Park, and it's called Team America World Police. And it's just a big parody about how everywhere America goes, and they claim that they spread liberty and democracy, they actually destroy the country and give rise to even more powerful groups than the one that preceded them. And that is just essentially what ISIS is. You know, we know that almost 3,000 people died in 9/11. You know, I remember I was about 14 years old and I sit there and I cry and we took the rest of the day off from school. And it was one of the most traumatizing things I ever saw in my life. And it was extremely wrong and it was immoral in every way, shape, or form. However, 9/11 was a military attack by Islamic fundamentalists that should not be blanketed as all people who follow the Muslim faith. So that's first and foremost. These people, you know, and then of course you have people like suicide bombers, you understand? And they only show you certain aspects of it. You know, they have an old African power, but it's three sides of the story, your side, my side, and the truth. And since America has been, as Ali, I should say, re-entered the Middle East, good work over there. And people don't ask the question, like we could say, you know, we could count, and every time an American soldier is murdered, you know, it's on our TV sets. But we never ask ourselves, well, how many people they killed over there? And right now, the death toll that Americans have done in the Middle East is more than 12 million Muslim people, the vast majority of which are non-combatants.
So, Chris,
like these people just wake up one day and say, you know what, I don't like America. You know what, I don't like this. You know what, I don't like that.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying that what they do is right, and I'm not, you know, trying to side with anyone politically, but I'm just giving it from both sides, from perspective as a honest and responsible historian. In 200 years, I truly believe that when historians look back at that, the Americans will not be seen as the people on the right side of history. And you can talk all the politics you want. You can't compare a few thousand deaths to the deaths of over 12 million people.
That's
thank you.
You're welcome. I would have phrased it, ISIS is the product of American foreign policy gone awry, and imperialism,
right?
And it's unfortunate because essentially I think people thought America was coming in to save them and then realized that possibly they were pawns or collateral damage in a grander global political agenda. And those people became dissatisfied with the U.S. and its own country, right? And so now we just have chaos. If you come from it from a youth sort of perspective, is it Hydra? When you cut off one head, two heads spring back, right?
Yeah.
And ISIS is one of those unintended consequences, right, of a poorly strategized foreign agenda.
And of course, we know that the crux of this, the Middle East, is slightly similar, not... It holds certain important similarities when you look at the resources. Remember now, we know why they went to the Middle East. They got oil.
But Chris, let's not go there. I got a more important question to ask you, man.
Let's move.
I need some personal advice. I make drink and I sell Bush tea, all kinds of Bush tea. But apparently somebody showed me that I may be breaking the law. Like I may be a criminal, right? And it's like you talking foolishness. Because, you know, just because I tell people drink their Bush in odd numbers does not mean...
All right.
I practice in Obeah. In fact, I'm a Chikchani. And there's nothing in the law that says I can't be a Chikchani. Why would these people tell me that telling the people to drink the Bush in odd numbers is Obeah?
If you look at our statutes, you know, we love... The people who love, you know, the pastors, you know, the ones who have the platform, I call them this, but they love to brag about religious freedom in this country. Religious freedom only exists for people who follow either one, Abrahamic-based religions, or two, other religions like, you know, a Buddhist or a Hindu could get away because it's not as demonized as West African religion. Not realizing that West African religion is still illegal in the Bahamas to this day. And when you read the laws, it's at the last part, it says even for restoring a person to health.
Okay.
Now,
what?
In the Dicko situation, you would love this, Aaron. You're sitting down, right?
Yeah. Quick, because I
got
to
call. So there was a rumor after the death of Dick DeVoe that he had somehow been resuscitated.
What?
Well, so where did that rumor come from?
Hold tight.
It come from the ramblings of Kid Island Obeah that existed from 200 years ago. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Now, Obeah itself is a... Right.
Good. Let me take this caller and then tell us what Obeah means after that. Caller, you're on the clock. Caller, you there? Caller, you still there? You're safe? I think you're in the juju tree and your phone dropped. You safe? Okay, caller, I give you one more second. I know you was waiting a long time. Call back, sir. Call back.
Okay.
All right, go on. So when the call comes in, I got to take it, Chris, but let's continue.
Yeah, no problem. Now, Obeah is for us, for the African in the Bahamas. We should look at Obeah, the term, from two perspectives. Now, you have the Obeah, which was essentially nothing that was so scientific or anything. All Obeah was, from the English perspective, was anything of African descent that these African people doing that in of Jesus Christ and it's make us feel uncomfortable. And that was inclusive of Bush medicine.
Okay.
You have reports all throughout the English Caribbean, particularly in Barbados, of the most racist and the most cruelest slave master laying down sick on his deathbed. The European doctor coming in and all they're doing is putting leeches on them and drawing blood, all sorts of quote-unquote primitive medicinal forms. And those same racist slave masters would go and call mommy from the back to mix that same Obeah medicine that they're talking about.
Absolutely.
Things that we do on the daily, words that we say on the daily were considered phobia.
Stick a pin. Hold on. Stick a pin.
By the brush, right?
All right. Stick a pin. 1 second. Call us back on the line. Caller, you're on the clock.
Maybe they need to turn their radio down or something.
But listen.
Miss Erin Green, good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Morning, sir.
Oh, I am better than most, not as good as you. Well, I just happened to be in the car, but of course, listening to Roger Radio, and you talk about something that is significant to me. Mita Rose.
Yes, sir.
Cat Island.
Uh-huh.
Yes, sir.
But I understand those are all over the country. My great-grandfather, James, was born on Christmas Day, 1879. He had his first child in 1900 before he got married. And his father, we didn't know too much about his father, but his father was Joe DeVoe. And Joe DeVoe lived just east of Market Street. Just east of Market Street on Wolf Road. I know about a lot about Africa. But when you start, and I know a whole lot about my other side, the Pennison family.
Yes,
Africans. So, tell me what you recommend.
We can't hear you, sir.
Can't hear you well at all.
Yeah. But listen, this is the perfect time to say it because Zoom. So, the sound was just too much. Now, the sound issues. But like I was saying, Chris, Zoom have to be obeah. How could you have 100 people on one call from all over the world one time having the same conversation? That gets to be obeah.
Right. See, and this is the attitude we have to reflect. So essentially, from the British perspective, it was anything that we did that they did not approve of. Uh-huh. Now, from our perspective, if we were to find Bahamian obeah, being the African spiritual system or the African religion, whatever you want to call it, that existed here, it is actually quite unique. And it's an amalgamation and a combination of various different West African spiritual systems that go all the way up from Senegal, go straight down to Congo. Mm-hmm. So the more scarier aspects of Bahamian Obeah that you see in Kid Island, a lot of it comes from the Congo region called Mayombe. And there's a religion that's very popular in Cuba. It's called Palo Mayombe. You understand? Mm-hmm. This is where, and we don't have time to get into this before. We got to do a whole another one for me to get into this type of stuff. But when you look at these regions, these are the most demonized regions in Africa and also some of the most amazing regions. These are the regions where people like the Great Queen Nzinga, who fought against the Portuguese for 40 years against the transatlantic slave trade and won and defeated them. And they was only able to take over a region after her death.
Wow.
So I figured that twice. You know, this areas these people come from, and this is the same areas that we are conditioned to fear.
Right.
These
are people conditioned to fear ourselves. Right.
These are people who had a form of medicine and that was combined with crime and punishment.
Mm-hmm.
That we know today as zombification. You understand? Their medicine was vastly superior.
So, Chris,
let's
get to some of those Obeah words and practices very quickly before.
You're saying that you said it at least 50 times from the beginning of the show.
One is drinking your bush medicine in odd numbers.
No, you say a word, juju.
Ah, juju. Right.
Now, of course, words and the etymology, they change definition over time. But if you would go to Nigeria today, juju essentially means... of course, in the British definition, it always has a negative connotation. And they don't even respect African culture enough to delve into this. So they just call our gods the juju. But juju actually means luck. So you could have good bad juju or bad juju. And it also has to do with me doing things to change your luck and to change your stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So if I'm in love with a woman, you know, she give me that good juju. You know what I mean? Because I feel like I in love. Feel like you put that good juju
that
on
energy,
me.
That energy, that spirit, right?
That energy, that what they call in the Yoruba spirit, Ori. Mm-hmm. We have another word, Iri. Everything I read, I read is derived from the Yoruba word irei, which, okay? You have overt Shango worship in the Bahamas. Anytime you see people dancing around the fire, putting fire in their mouth, spitting it out, that is Shango worship. And it's especially strong in Kid Island, where if you even read Eris Monka's book on Kid Island, you could see he doesn't plainly identify it as Shango worship. Rosaline Adderley, Roseanne Adderley also mentions it in a book, New Negroes from Africa. Wow. This Shango worship, that's the god of fire, thunder, justice. Just the same Yoruba deity that we used to call on when it was time to have slave revolts. We have another one called Ogun.
Okay.
Ogun.
Chris, is the Yoruba. Chris, we gotta go. I am out of time.
Oh, we gotta go.
But this is great because that means we know exactly where to pick up from the next time you come.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To my audience today, thank you. The audio is a little rough because Zoom is Obia. Y'all can't tell me nothing different. It have to be Obia.
Right, next time I could be in studio.
Yes, sir. But I think the conversation, remember that we, the people, get to determine who our heroes are, right? We get to determine who our celebrities will be. And we got to stop making celebrities and heroes of people who do not deserve it and show us on a daily basis that they do not deserve it and are not even striving to attain it, right? And so hopefully we can shift, have more conversations that focus on the values that we do want to inculcate in our society, right? And so it was a bit of a lot, because that's Obia, and we could do that. And I want us to have a great day. I'm going to just quickly read the couple of texts that came in today. Even the speaker's resignation, in my view, was a halfway message built on retaining his salary. The honorable thing to do was make it complete. Even though I disagree with the Oban deal, it beats the BPC Davis and Christie deal done out of pure greed and all for me, baby. Attitude, at least Oban interests of trying... Spark, don't laugh on the air, sir. Trying spark economic activities in Grand Bahama. There's another text I have to read. Miss Green, morning, FNM, two straight, FNM, FNM, maybe three, FNM. Buddy, that's a sweet, sweet dream you have in there. Great show as usual. You know you could get lockup for Thief and Juju. Right food for thought. But look here, there's plenty of things you're supposed to get locked up for in this town. But if they try to lock me up for Thief and Juju, and they don't lock these big gray back man up for trolling outside the high schools, thank God the high schools close, eh? Trolling up these little children and big gray back woman. Please don't arrest me for Thief and the Juju. Just blow your horn, police, and say, Miss Green, get out the tree and go home. Bahamas.
Our disregard for that safety is just a part of our colonial history.
As As well. Yeah. Chris, I gotta go. Get back to the people, them good job. Bahamas, thanks. Thanks for tuning in with me today, Bahamas. Thanks for learning about Dick DeVoe and his story and how it impacts all of our lives today in 2021. Levon Miller with Unleashed is next on Guardian 96.9 FM. Have a great day, Bahamas.